It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. On December 12, 1934, police raided a canning factory in Cedar Rapids. What they found was an illegal bar and gambling setup, and that incident set off a year-long investigation into graft that reached into all levels of the Iowa state government. That investigation was driven by a man named Vern Marshall, the editor of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Jerry Harrington tells the story in his new book, Crusading Iowa Journalist Vern Marshall, Exposing Graft and the 1936 Pulitzer Prize. And Jerry is here with me now. Hello, Jerry.
How do you do?
I'm great. Thank you so much for being here. And Vern Marshall is a name I had never heard before picking up this book. How did you find out about him? How did he come to your attention?
Well, I was approached by a company called the History Press, based in South Carolina, and they contacted me because I'd written a series of articles for the Iowa History Journal on Iowa history, political history, and they said, do you want to take a subject and turn it into a book? So I said, fine. So I searched around, and I was reading one book by former Des Moines Register reporter George Mills called One-Armed Bandits and Other Stories. And in this book, he describes the gambling issues of the 1980s and 90s, but as a preface, he pointed out to this pointed to this amazing episode in the 1930s when a Cedar Rapids Gazette editor exposed this network of gambling, slot machines, illegal liquor operations, other crimes, you name it, going on throughout Iowa. And I'd never heard of it before. So I started looking into that, and of course you can pull out old issues of the Gazette. And Vern Marshall's papers are at the Hoover Library in West Branch, which is a short drive down the road from my home in Iowa City. So I started investigating that, and this incredibly interesting story emerged. Not only was it a story of intrigue in Iowa and corruption and what investigative journalism can do, but it ended up with this reporter winning the Pulitzer Prize on the national scale. And he is an amazing character. And if you were a reader of the Cedar Rapids Gazette in this period in the 1930s, you were exposed to a lot of quite interesting journalism.
Absolutely. He had a very strong voice. You used some snippets of his writing throughout the book.
Oh, yeah.
First, before we get into that raid in 1934, tell me a little bit about Vern Marshall and what brought him to the Gazette.
Well, he was born into journalism. His father owned a third of the Gazette. And Vern Marshall originally, as a kid, a 16-year-old, won a statewide prize for writing about Theodore Roosevelt's inauguration. And he said that got him into journalism. He went to Europe during World War I and saw the carnage of fighting there, came back, and worked for a number of newspapers, Minneapolis, Sioux City, the Cedar Rapids Republican in Cedar Rapids, and eventually by 1920 got a job with the Gazette, or 1919 got a job with the Gazette with his father. And it was in 1920 and 21 where Vern Marshall had his first series of exposés. He was just a new father and had a young daughter, and he was looking around for milk that had been assured safety against bovine tuberculosis. And what he found was that the person responsible for regulating that, the commissioner of dairy and food sanitation, was importing cattle into Iowa from Wisconsin without checking for bovine tuberculosis. Well, Marshall wrote about this in 1920-21 and got the guy fired, got the state to look into it. And this was probably his most important series of exposés because it really made life safer for individuals in Iowa, and it saved lives. 10 years later, Marshall turned his eyes toward Iowa City and the University of Iowa, and he exposed a network of basically old boys that operated the university. There was a deposit from the Rockefeller Foundation that would help support expansion of the university hospital, and that was deposited in a bank which was owned by the treasurer of the university. The treasurer, the owner of the bank, did not give any interest to this fund. Marshall pointed that out. He also pointed out that Employees of the university were using private homes, using university employees to improve those. They were issuing contracts based on favoritism. And Marshall also attacked the president of the university, Walter Jessup, for contributing to athletic scholarships in an age where this was illegal. These were not uncontroversial.
I was going to say, he seems like a man who was not afraid to make enemies.
Not at all, no. In fact, I cite one episode of my book where he heard that there were Iowa City merchants that were going to urge Cedar Rapids businesses to boycott the Gazette, and he lashed out at them. I mean, you could tell in his typing that he was a guy who would sit at his typewriter and he'd get angrier as each sentence poured out. One reference to Vern Marshall by Lyle Mueller, who was the former editor of the Gazette, was that he called him a rascal. and he was. He was not afraid at all. When he saw public graft, or when he saw someone taking money that was supposed to go to public efforts or doing something wrong, he had no qualms at all about putting them on the front page of the Gazette. He's been called sort of one of the last of the old-fashioned newspaper editors, in that he used the newspaper and wrote articles to take on anybody. I mean, the word muckraker was used to describe him. And you know, if you look at the history of American journalism, you see in the 19th and early 20th century the demise of newspapers that were purely partisan, and the rise in the early 20th century of newspapers that were quote-unquote objective and reported the news objectively. Marshall kind of carried
Walk
over that
line.
Yeah. I mean, he also had a column on the front page of the Gazette every day called Current Comments. And it was not unbiased. I mean, he expressed his opinions very clearly, distinctly. And if you were a wrongdoer or you were a corruptionist, if you took graft, your name was in there, and he didn't care. He invited libel suits, and he got them.
All right, let's go back to that night in December 12th, 1934. And before we talk about what they found, we need to take a little snapshot of that period in time, because we think about illegal bars and we think about prohibition, but this was post-prohibition.
It was, yeah. Prohibition was officially repealed in December 1933. And Iowa, through its state legislature, which met in extraordinary session in 1933-34, passed the Iowa Liquor Control Act. And that set up a commission which set up a liquor monopoly in Iowa. The only way you could buy liquor was through the state liquor stores. And you could not import liquor into the state. You could not sell liquor over the counter in terms of drinks. You could sell beer, but it had to be 3.2 beer, and they were set up in beer taverns that could not house liquor. So that was the system. And there was a commission that set up these liquor stores. And what happened on this night is that the Cedar Rapids police, together with state police, walked into a canning factory, and in the basement they found a bar that was owned by J. Leroy Farmer. And that, you know, was not unusual. They'd done that before throughout the state in this age after
right,
Prohibition was
repealed. Doesn't seem like such a big deal.
Yeah. What was a big deal is that Farmer pulled out an envelope he'd gotten from the head of the Liquor Commission, Harold Cooper. And Harold Cooper had sent him 200 state seals to put on his bottles of liquor to make it seem as if they were legal.
And he sent the letter on the state letterhead as well.
Yeah.
These are seals you can use.
Yeah. And so Vern Marshall got a hold of that within minutes, called the commissioner on the phone, and said, what's the deal? And Cooper said, well, Farmer brought his liquor in from Wisconsin. He's a good businessman. He wanted to be on the up and up, so I sent him the seals. Marshall took that down, and then he called him back after he wrote the story and said, okay, here's your quotes. I want this verified. Yeah, sure, fine. So he ran with the story. Hours later, Cooper issued a second statement saying that Farmer had these liquor supplies since
before Prohibition,
which in Iowa was 1916. That's when Iowa had its own statewide prohibition. Well, that was a fatal mistake on Cooper's part. I mean, obviously, he met with, well, I'm speculating here, but he may have met with some legal advice that said, wait a minute, you've just admitted to violating the law. So that started Marshall on a crusade to investigate other state issues.
Well, and Farmer, the guy who owned the bar, he tipped him off right away. He said, oh, this goes everywhere in the state.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He said, and what he said to the police is, I don't want Vern Marshall to know this and plaster this all over the state. Well, which is exactly what happened. What did happen with Cooper is that the Linn County attorney filed charges against him, and there was a trial in Linn County against the head of the liquor commission and commissioner, and he was found guilty.
But he refused to resign.
Yeah. One clause in the law that was a bit hastily written is that the governor could appoint the commissioner, but the governor couldn't fire him. So it took the bombardment of such newspapers as the Gazette and Marshall that daily called for Cooper's resignation. And, in fact, the governor was calling for Cooper's resignation, but he refused to go. Eventually, at a point, he did agree to resign. And then he took his case to the Supreme Court of Iowa. And then, for some reason, there was a flaw in the law that got him off. But that was about a year and a half later.
So, and we took a snapshot in time talking about alcohol laws, but also we need to point out that this was at a time where the political winds of change had been blowing, and there was a Democratic governor, Democratic House, Democratic Senate.
Yeah. The election of 1932 was the Roosevelt landslide, and for the first time really since the 1850s, Democrats controlled the executive posts in the Iowa government. There was one Democrat elected governor in 1889 and 1891, but he was a former Republican. So this was really the first time the Democrats had complete control of Iowa government. And my speculation is that there were some of them said, well, now is our turn. And there was a bit of shenanigans in state government.
And we'll find out more about those in just a moment. I'm talking with Jerry Harrington. He's just written the book, Crusading Iowa Journalist Vern Marshall, Exposing Graft and the 1936 Pulitzer Prize. We're finding out about this remarkable story this hour. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're finding out about an unusual story in Iowa history. Jerry Harrington has just written the book, Crusading Iowa Journalist Vern Marshall, Exposing Graft and the 1936 Pulitzer Prize. And as we've been talking about, this all started with a raid on an illegal bar in Cedar Rapids and the discovery that there was a connection between the man who was running the bar and the Iowa Liquor Commission. And from there, this crusading editor of the Cedar Rapids Gazette, Vern Marshall, decided to find out a lot more about what was going on. It wasn't just the commissioner. It went a lot farther than that. And his research led him to the other side of the state, to Woodbury County.
Yeah, to Sioux City. What he did was try to find some way, somehow, that this illegal activity could lead to Des Moines. And one of the things that he did find is that there were people who were willing to talk to him in Sioux City to bring together and link the corruption that was going on, as he saw it, in state government to those in Des Moines that in turn affected the state and affected the good citizens of Cedar Rapids. He sent a private investigator to Sioux City from Chicago. And
that seems like a fairly unusual
way
of doing research as a newspaper man.
Yeah, but it wasn't hard to find information there either. You know, Sioux City at the time, in the 1930s, it was, as I describe it, it was crossways between settled farm area and the Wild West. And the laws there were rather loosely enforced. I cite a quote from the an individual that say that, you know, you've got ranchers and farmers and others who want to come to the city and have drinks and gamble and all. And he was the county attorney and who played a major role in the episode. And so before Marshall got to Sioux City, he started investigating state contracts, that is road contracts, sales of material to the state. And he discovered that in order to do business with the state of Iowa, you had to mark up your bid by 5%. And the 5% went into the Democratic Campaign Fund, which really didn't fund too many campaigns. It went into someone's pocket. And Marshall had an ally in this expose, a young state representative from Linn County by the name of Burke Hickenlooper, who later on became lieutenant governor, governor, and longtime U.S. senator. And he got the head of the Democratic Party to resign, E.J. Fueling of New Hampton. But his road to Sioux City took him first to the state legislature, where he testified about what was going on in Sioux City, which was, among other things, that a slot machine operation was set up whereby if you had a slot machine, which was illegal in Iowa, you paid $1 a year to the local officials or to state officials that were connected up to the state, and that protected you. All your slot machines from one, raids, or two, if someone was ambitious enough to have a raid, you were warned in advance. And what Marshall figured out is there was this underworld figure by the name of Joe Gagan, who was connected with certain officials who he collected the money, and the money went upstairs, that is, to Des Moines.
And Joe Gagan was a bad guy.
Well, he was, as I say, an underworld figure, and he had contacts throughout
the
state.
And we're talking about mafia.
Yeah.
Possibly.
As far as I was concerned,
right,
yeah.
Right, but he had a manslaughter charge.
Yeah,
and
yeah. Yeah.
Been connected to a lot of nefarious activities.
Right. And another person that Marshall connected with in Sioux City in an amazing overnight conversation was the county attorney called Max Duckworth. And, I mean, I kind of sympathized with this poor guy. He was a young attorney, elected county attorney in Woodbury County, was immersed in this corruption, could not get out of it. And he went to see Marshall in a hotel room, entered the hotel room at 5 p.m., and didn't leave until 1:30. And Marshall just interrogated him for all those hours. In fact, finally...
But he went himself to the hotel room, and that kind of slayed me, because this isn't the only time in this investigation where people just go and talk to Vern Marshall and then wind up on the pages of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Why did people keep talking to him?
Well, for one thing, they knew that Vern Marshall would print stuff no matter what. I mean, I'm speculating here. I think Duckworth went to see Marshall because he knew his name would get involved in somehow, so he wanted to present his side of the story. He went to him again the next day and said that, you know, I'm not involved in about 90% of the stuff here, but the 10% I am involved in, I really can't tell you about without me getting in knee deep.
And he wanted a certain level of immunity. I mean, this is way outside the law, but immunity from Marshall. He wanted Marshall to say, okay, I'm not going to write about you as long as you give me information.
Yeah, and the agreement was that Marshall wouldn't write about him as long as Duckworth prosecuted the corruptionists and the wrongdoers, as Marshall would refer to them in his columns. Well, as it happened, and Marshall went back to Cedar Rapids, Duckworth did nothing of that sort. In fact, he was, according to Marshall, lying through his teeth. So there was a grand jury. There were two grand juries in Woodbury County that were set up. One forced the commissioner of public safety to resign, but really didn't take any other action. I think the head of police resigned as well. Then Marshall started issuing his exposés throughout April.
One after another.
Oh, yeah, and a whole number of different issues. There was one where... he exposed the 5% markup. Another, he exposed the attorney general of the state of Iowa mixing in with gangsters in Sioux City and drinking to excess and being carried out of a bar.
Right, and the attorney general did seem to have a serious drinking problem.
Edward O'Connor of Iowa City was elected, along with Clyde Herring, governor, and the rest of the Democrats in 1932. The night he was elected in 1932, O'Connor was picked up for drunken driving. This is the attorney general of the state of Iowa. He had a good lawyer, Walter Malley of Des Moines, who got him off. And in exchange for that, O'Connor appointed Walter Malley as his first assistant attorney general. So
he got off to a great start.
Yeah, and this is one of the connections that Vern Marshall established through Duckworth, among others, that Walter Malley had connections with Joe Gagan and was part of the syndicate. Well, after all these exposés came out, and of course they were covered in other media throughout the state as well, This Sioux City grand jury began, a second grand jury was called in, and they hired Horace Havner, who was a former attorney general in the 1920s, and 19-teens. And Horace Havner was a bulldog of an attorney. And the eventual result was that by July 3rd, 1935, about 50 individuals were indicted for graft, corruption, et cetera, including the Attorney General of the state of Iowa, Edwin O'Connor. And all of them were protesting their innocence, and they wanted to throw the indictments out, except for one. They wanted to take it all the way to the Supreme Court, but one person wanted to go ahead with a trial, and that was Edward O'Connor. He wanted to get this thing out of the way before he was running for re-election in 1936, and that set up this explosive trial in Sioux City, where the Attorney General of the state of Iowa was on trial for graft and corruption. And that was a fascinating 7-week trial.
Very expensive.
It was expensive in the 1930s, and the good people of Woodbury County were being told to carry on the expenses of a statewide trial. They really had, you know, a lot of them really didn't care about. In fact, there was a backlash against this by a lot of citizens from Sioux City that were protesting this to the governor. It did start. I mean, it went ahead. And the main witness against O'Connor was Max Duckworth. He could tie O'Connor, if not directly to the payments, at least he could tie him to mass negligence because he knew that O'Connor knew. I mean, he had direct conversations with the Iowa Attorney General on these activities.
So he's the star witness.
Yeah. So it was on the third day that Duckworth took the stand, and that's when the bombshell hit. Max Duckworth was promised immunity by the grand jury. When he took the stand, he pleaded the fifth. He would not testify. And my reasoning, I think, when just kind of reading between the lines, he saw this case of the others indicted going to the Supreme Court, thinking the Supreme Court would throw it out due to a mistake by Vern Marshall, and that they would throw out the immunity. So the star witness did not testify.
Clammed up.
Yeah. And one of the problems was that Vern Marshall had contributed $700 to the expenses for Horace Havner. And that was the issue that these 50 indicted individuals took to the Iowa Supreme Court that eventually threw it all out. But the trial continued. And it got to a point in late December where the jury met after all the evidence was collected, and the prosecution under Havner brought some pretty unsavory guys to the stand. I mean, there was a prisoner from Fort Madison whose credibility was suspect at best, several others, and they were all involved in these underworld activities, and O'Connor's lawyers left and right just, you know, criticized their credibility, et cetera. The jury went to reach a verdict. It could not reach a verdict. It voted 10-2 for his acquittal, but there were two self-proclaimed housewives that absolutely refused to believe that the Attorney General of Iowa was innocent. And they stood by their opinions, and they would not back down. So it was a hung jury, and the judge declared it a mistrial. A few weeks later, another jury was called, and within minutes, they dismissed charges against O'Connor.
Why?
Well, because it was just so darn expensive to have the trial.
It was going to cost too much money to have another trial.
Yeah,
so
and it was. I mean,
forget about it.
Yeah, I mean, it was tens of thousands of dollars that this cost, and this was 1935-36 in Iowa. It was still in the depths of the Great Depression. I think there are a lot of people in Woodbury County that were wondering what they're doing, trying an attorney general who was from Iowa City, based in Des Moines. And, you know,
Well, and this these exposés that Vern Marshall had been writing, I mean, this had gone on for basically a year.
Yeah.
This information's coming out, and at first it's making sensation after sensation. People are hanging on his every word.
Yeah.
By the end, people are like, enough already.
Yeah, yeah.
There was definitely a backlash against Marshall, too.
Yeah, there was. And especially when, time after time, those indicted were accusing him of simply being a mouthpiece for the Republican Party.
And was there something to that?
That I could not. I just, the evidence doesn't show that he was. He was a mouthpiece for Vern Marshall. As far as I was concerned. Yeah.
Now, he, for this reporting, he won the Pulitzer Prize.
Yes.
When did that come into play with all of these trials taking place?
It was in early May of 1936 that the Pulitzer Prize Committee announced that he won it for meritorious journalism, and that was the very same day that the Iowa Supreme Court threw out the 50 indictments against those indicted. And so the front page of the Cedar Rapids Gazette says, Gazette wins Pulitzer, and then the headline beneath it is, 50 indictments thrown out by the Supreme Court.
Did that tarnish the prize at all for Marshall?
No, not at all. Not according to Marshall. No. I mean, he said he won in the court of public opinion. Simply because the court system did not convict did not mean that there were not guilty individuals in Iowa.
Now, with so much of his reporting did seem to be biased, and by today's judgment, that would not have won him a Pulitzer Prize.
Probably not. Yeah, yeah. I mean, he would write news items on his newspaper. They were often first person. And he would write them as if it were something out of a Sinclair Lewis novel. I mean, is it just he would call individuals corruptionists and liars in his news copy. But the main direction of what he exposed, I would argue, was true. I mean, you might argue with his style, but I don't think you'd argue with the facts that he brought up. And as it happened, he ended certain individuals that were corrupt within the Democratic Party at the time. He essentially ended the slot machine operation. He made people think twice about it. The attorney general who succeeded O'Connor really clamped down on it. The legislatures passed laws against it. He made changes.
What do you think the real impact over the years was? I mean, maybe, all right, government was more accountable to people. How did he carry forward as a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist?
Well, for the rest of the 1930s, he ranted and raved against individuals within the Democratic Party. To this extent, you know, he showed his Republican side, true, but he would say he had ammunition. Then later on in the late 1930s, early 40s, he took the national stage. And Vern Marshall set up what was called the No Foreign Wars Committee, which opposed the United States' entry into the Second World War. This was allied with the America First organization, which was led by Charles Lindbergh, who was famous for crossing the Atlantic in 1927. Lindbergh was based in the Midwest. Vern Marshall was based on the East Coast. But Marshall was a little bit less genteel than Lindbergh. Basically, Marshall ticked off everyone he ran into and alienated everybody. The same sort of...
Even people who agreed with him.
Yeah, yeah. The same sort of aggressiveness that fought against the corruptionists in Iowa really doomed him in this organization. Eventually, the organization fell apart because of that. And eventually, shortly afterwards, he suffered a nervous breakdown and had to go to a sanitarium in Wisconsin. Where he simply faded from the public scene. The next he was heard of was in the 1950s when he wrote a column for the Marion Sentinel from 1953 to 1957. So this giant on the stage left the stage in a bit of a whimper.
You actually heard from one of his daughters recently.
I did. The book's been out for about a month or so, and I got a call from Frances Lang, and she called me up, and said she liked the book.
Nice.
And she's 90 years old and has to read a book through a big magnifying glass, but a delightful lady to talk to. And she told me stories about needing armed guards during times when, especially during the No Foreign Wars Committee time, trips to school, that she had to be driven to school because of threats against the family.
Wow. Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We've been talking about Iowa journalist Vern Marshall. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1936. He was the editor of the Cedar Rapids Gazette and clearly a force of nature. Jerry Harrington has written about his life and work and this particular episode in the book, Crusading Iowa Journalist Vern Marshall, Exposing Graft and the 1936 Pulitzer Prize. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest this hour is Jerry Harrington. He's just published a book called Crusading Iowa Journalist Vern Marshall, Exposing Graft and the 1936 Pulitzer Prize. We've been talking about really a remarkable year in the life of Vern Marshall and everyone in state government in Iowa during that time. And we have a caller on the line. Iowa Public Radio's Dean Borg has something he wants to add to the conversation. Hi, Dean.
Good morning, Charity. Not to divert your attention away from Vern Marshall, who I'm learning a lot about, and I wish I had known him, but you asked a question a few minutes ago about the lasting effect of what he did. Did that make any changes in Iowa? Well, that caused me to remember something that I was involved in just tangentially. I was on the staff of the WMT stations, Channel 2 and WMT Radio in Cedar Rapids, in the early 1960s, when Martin Jensen, an investigative reporter, under the direction of Grant Price, who was then the news director, uncovered a scandal within the Iowa Liquor Control Commission, which again, as your guest has described, controlled all liquor sales in Iowa. And the scandal eventually amounted to the Liquor Control Commission getting kickbacks from liquor manufacturers and then pocketing that themselves, but were kicking back for stocking things that weren't even selling. They had warehouses full of liquor in Iowa that wasn't selling, but they were making money from buying it. And this turned out to be quite a scandal in the early 1960s. And Martin Jensen, Grant Price were involved in that. And that eventually, I think, helped Iowa to say we've got to change things. And Harold Hughes then campaigned on reform in the way that liquor was sold in Iowa. And that's how Iowa eventually got liquor by the drink, and that was one of the campaign principles of Harold Hughes when he became governor. I just would say one thing, too, in passing, and then I'll get off. That is, Iowa's had some really good investigative reporters. Vern Marshall apparently was one of them, a real winner. But look at Brian Ross, who now is with ABC News, began up in Charles City, then went to Channel 7 in Waterloo. In fact, his career in Iowa was, and he is ABC News now, chief investigative reporter, but his career in Iowa was cut short because his employer thought that he was too aggressive.
Interesting. Oh, Dean, thank you so much for sharing that. And actually, we have a connection to what you were just talking about with Governor Harold Hughes changing the liquor laws in Iowa. Before we dig into that, though, I want to read this email from Carrie. She says, my father worked for the Gazette in various capacities starting in the early 40s. By the 50s, I dimly remember that the cloud of communism hovered around Marshall's reputation among the paper's staff. She says, pretty effective way of defanging him. Did you find anything out about that?
I would not say communism did. I would say, conversely, he was vehemently anti-communist. There was, if you look at his columns in the 1950s in the Marion Sentinel, that stands out quite a bit.
Interesting. Well, and I want to move into our conversation about Harold Hughes. You've just written an article about Harold Hughes, published in the Annals of Iowa, which is published by the State Historical Society of Iowa, about the very thing that Dean Borg just brought up. He campaigned on getting liquor by the drink legalized in Iowa. This was in 1963, which seems pretty late to be having that conversation.
It was very late for the Midwest because Iowa was the only state in the Midwest that didn't have liquor by the drink. And when Dean talked about investigative reporters, let's also bring in the Des Moines Register because the Des Moines Register is partially responsible for raising the issue. In 1962, in May, the Register, under the leadership of George Mills, wrote a series of articles showing that the liquor by the drink laws, which prohibited serving liquor over the counter in individual drinks, was being violated in 66 out of the 99 counties.
And so two-thirds of the state.
Yeah, yeah. So Harold Hughes, a Democratic candidate for governor, quite early on said, okay, you either do one of two things. Either you enforce the law or you change it. And what's fascinating, of course, about Hughes is that he was a recovering alcoholic. That was not a big issue in the campaign, but he didn't hide it. He took this issue, defeated the incumbent governor, Norman Irby.
And was that the defining issue of the campaign?
It was the major issue.
Really?
Yeah. Now, Hughes would say there were many other issues involved in it, but boy, this was the main one. And, in fact, I think it was the Gazette came out with a headline, Hughes elected liquor mandate. And what did happen is that Hughes was elected, and in the interim between the time he was elected and the time he took office, local county governments started enforcing the law and started drying up Iowa. And it really affected the economy of the state. You had conventions leaving Sioux City, going to South Sioux City. You had Dubuque bars or areas that were serving liquor cease serving them. And after Hughes was elected or took office, he started enforcing the law with his own forces. There were raids all over the state. And what he did was put fire under the legislature to change, because the problem was the Iowa legislature was apportioned geographically. Each county had one representative in the House, and the top eight had an additional representative, but it was really skewed toward rural interests, and they dominated the politics of the state. So Hughes started aggressively enforcing the law, started abolishing liquor by the drink, and it was especially the first movement was in the Senate, where there were more urban senators than there were rural, and eventually the liquor by the drink law passed 26-24, and it was very close and not at all guaranteed when they took that vote. Then it went over to the House, and by this time the general consensus was that, okay, it's passed. The people want it. We're going to pass it. So it did. And in 1963, Iowa got liquor by the drink from this led by this recovering alcoholic.
And you, in your article, you quote someone that we've come to know very, very well in Iowa. You quote Charles Grassley, who was a member of the House at that point.
Yeah, at one point, Grassley looked at the enforcement that Hughes was executing. And he said, well, maybe this proves that we can really enforce the law. Few people agreed with that. But Grassley was convinced dry, and if he had his druthers, the liquor by the drink would not have passed. But he also could count votes, too. And so it did eventually pass.
Yeah, he said, many sincere dries want to be able to vote for liquor by the drink. They've conditioned their action on the acceptance of complied consent by the Senate. While noting that I would like to see liquor by the drink killed every place, he admitted it appears that liquor by the drink will pass this session.
Yeah.
Well, and it's so interesting that the history of the alcohol laws in Iowa are fascinating and deep. And we have a couple of people with questions for you. And Steve is on the line with a personal story. You're welcome to join our conversation as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. My guest this hour is Jerry Harrington. Steve in Des Moines, what would you like to talk about?
Well, when I was a kid, my folks lived in Logan, Iowa, just, you know, over the river from Omaha. And they used to drive up with friends of theirs and go out on Friday nights, and I'm pretty sure it was because they could get cocktails up there. And I remember my dad taking me to a tavern in town, and the only thing they'd serve was beer. So that's kind of answered my question. I wondered if that's why they were going to Omaha.
Yeah, the beer laws were different than the liquor laws. In April of 1933, Congress passed a law establishing 3.2 beer as a non-intoxicating beverage in order to give energy to the beer industry during the Great Depression. Iowa followed up, I think, in April of 1933, establishing 3.2 beer as a non-intoxicating beverage, and that's where beer taverns came from. So you've got this stretch from the 1930s up until 1963 when the only legal beverage you could serve across the counter in a glass was beer, and 3.2 beer at that.
Interesting. Well, and that was part of this debate in 1963 because there were people that wanted to include beer in the bill.
Yeah, and they kept it separate. Yeah, yeah.
Including it would have done what?
Well, there were beer taverns that moved to serve liquor by the drink. So I'm not so sure of the nuances of that.
Right. So, but if it had been included, then the so-called dries could have tried to possibly get beer service also made illegal again in Iowa. Now, what got you to start looking at the history of the alcohol laws in Iowa? This is something that plays into both of the stories you've been sharing today.
Well, I wrote a paper when I was in college on the history of the Liquor Commission. This goes back to my interest in Iowa history in general. When I was a junior at Cornell College in Mount Vernon, Iowa, I took two courses that had an impact on me. One was a history course taught by Reverend Richard Thomas, who was also the head of the president of the Iowa Historical Society, and he encouraged his students to research Iowa history. Another course I took was in 20th century American literature, and I discovered the works of William Faulkner. And Faulkner spent his entire career virtually writing about a single county in Mississippi. And he showed me that you could talk about the universal by concentrating on the local. And I found that fascinating. And that's where I got my interest in Iowa history. Under Professor Thomas, wrote this paper on the history of the Liquor Commission, which tried to get published. I was too young to really do a good paper then. So these other articles that I find a fascinating subject, I've carried on with.
Interesting. Well, here's a question from listener Jerry. He says, Iowa has a reputation as a good government state. Do you think that reputation is accurate? Is the reputation a result of cleaner politics that followed these scandals, do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think Iowa does have a reputation as a good government state. I think, but the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. And from time to time, there are scoundrels who take advantage of good people or situations, and that just shows the need for a free and independent and aggressive media to call those who are not on the up and up to task.
Jerry, you are recently retired from your life spent in PR and marketing, but clearly you've always had a passion for Iowa history. You've published many articles over the years, but this has been something that you've pursued on your own, outside of a career. Why has it been important to you?
I think it's worthwhile knowing who we are by knowing what we were in the past, and it's just fun. I mean, I have the greatest enjoyment of going through the archives and pulling out material evidence from the past and blending it together into a story that other people will enjoy reading. And I mean, to me, that's what you should do when you're retired, is do what you love to do. And that's what's happened to me.
And you're also teaching?
I teach a course on the history of comic books.
So another historical subject.
Right,
for another day. But, you know, I've had the great pleasure over the last several years to talk to many amateur historians in Iowa. And I don't know, you just published a book on history, so maybe you don't get to be called an amateur historian. Mm. But it's so many people who are pursuing their interest and their passion in one topic or many topics in Iowa history. Do you feel like you're part of a community of amateur historians in Iowa? Because there are so many people that are doing this. This is something that people are communicating with each other about.
Yeah, and I just joined a Facebook page on Iowa historians or those that are interested in the Iowa past, and there's a lot of people on it. Yeah, so it is part of a community. It's part of a community that gathers together from time to time on a daily basis at the Historical Society downtown in Iowa City. There's a large group. It can be an interesting, fascinating subject, and what's fascinating to one person may not be a fascinating to another. But I find it very, very interesting.
So what's next for you? It seems like there have been just little nuggets of ideas that have led you down the path of researching fascinating stories like Vern Marshall. Do you have another idea that you are exploring?
Yeah, I'm researching a book on the life of Harold Hughes. He wrote his autobiographies.
The governor who
was elected. Governor for three two-year terms in the 1960s, and then served a single term as United States Senator from 1969 to 74. I find him to be a fascinating figure, both as governor and senator. What's especially interesting to me is his transition as governor from 1963 to his candidacy for the Senate in 68 in relation to the Vietnam War. Hughes came out against the war. When I'm doing research on where he stood in the mid-60s, he was right down the line supporting American forces in Vietnam. And, of course, he always supported the forces, but he started to oppose the policy toward the end of the 60s. And what I think is one of the most interesting Senate races in Iowa history is that between Harold Hughes in 1968 and Dave Standley. Two very attractive candidates, and Hughes, one of the greatest vote-getters in Iowa history, narrowly winning a Senate race because of his stand, I think, on the Vietnam War, and then serving a single term in the United States Senate and leaving simply because he wanted to go into the ministry. Harold Hughes was a self-proclaimed born-again Christian who was also a liberal Democrat, which makes him interesting, certainly in the context of our current politics.
Absolutely. Well, you'll have to come back and tell us more about Governor Hughes, Senator Hughes, in the future. Jerry Harrington, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Jerry Harrington is a historian. He spent many years researching Iowa history, publishing articles in the Iowa History Journal and other publications. His most recent work is Crusading Iowa Journalist Vern Marshall, Exposing Graft in the 1936 Pulitzer Prize, a book that he's just published, and also an article called Iowa's Last Liquor Battle, Governor Harold E. Hughes and the Liquor by the Drink Conflict. That's published in the Annals of Iowa, the winter 2017 publication. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can get in touch with us anytime. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter at IPR Talk. I'm there too, at Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.